listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Colson Whitehead's books are known for, among many other qualities, their sense of the absurd and for his ingenious and wickedly funny and starkly original writing. His groundbreaking debut novel, The Intuitionists, Concerning Intrigue in the Department of Elevator Inspectors, was hailed as, quote, the freshest racial allegory since Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. And since that first novel, Colson has published a number of award-winning books, such as John Henry Day's The Colossus of New York, Apex Hides the Hurt, Sag Harbor, and Zone One, a New York Times bestseller about post-apocalyptic New York. He was last here to talk about that. Colson Whitehead has received a MacArthur Fellowship, a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Whiting Writers Award, and has been a fellow at the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers at the New York Public Library. And his newest book tonight, The Noble Hustle, Poker, Beef Jerky, and Death, takes off from his journey to the 2011 World Series of Poker, where Colson represented his homeland, the Republic of Anhedonia, in the biggest card game of the year, and where he learns that playing it safe is the ultimate sucker's strategy. How many of you here tonight happen to be poker players, I wonder? Just a few sprinkling of you here and there. Okay, just curious. And Colson will discuss his foray into the world of high-stakes poker with Lori Weiner, a writer, critic, and founding editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books. And we have a contingent here from the Los Angeles Review of Books, which you should all check out. It's fantastic. Lori's been a staff writer at the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Los Angeles Times. You can read, reliably find her witty and astute essays in the Los Angeles Review of Books. She's currently working on a book herself, Oscar Hammerstein and the Birth of the Musical. She got to hang out with Bryan Cranston to write about Breaking Bad for Los Angeles Magazine. I was very jealous. And she's played poker in Vegas, Macau, and every card room in Southern California. I think some of her poker cohort is here tonight. So we will now roll the dice and please welcome Colson Whitehead and Lori Weiner. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks everyone for coming. This is Colson's new book. Every so often there's a great poker book, A Dispatch from the World of Poker. 1981, Al Alvarez, The Biggest Game in Town, was first classic. And then in 2001, we had Positively Fifth Street by James McManus, which was also fabulous. And this is the third great dispatch from the poker world. Colson went to the World Series of Poker and for a magazine, Grantland, and tells us about the denizens, the gamblers. I don't know what gamblers are like, but he tells us all about them, and it's really fascinating. I was going to ask him to read a little bit from the beginning of the book, where he first goes to Atlantic City to kind of try out his poker skills way before he gets to Vegas, and he notices what the people are like. So, if you
would. I would also like to thank you guys for coming out and the library for having me back. It's always a good time. So as part of my training, it seemed to make sense to go to Atlantic City to learn how to play tournament poker, which is very different from the home game variety I've been playing. I sat down at a $1, $2 table with some types I would encounter with some frequency during my training, like Big Mitch. Big Mitch is a pot-bellied endomorph in fabric-softened khaki shorts and polo shirt, a middle-aged white guy here with his wife, who was off dropping chips on a roulette felt according to her patented system, fully equipped with a mortgage, a decent job, and disposable income. The segments of his thick metal watch band chick-chicked on his hairy wrist each time he entered the pot. Your average home player. What Big Mitch wants most, apart from coming home to see that young Caitlin hasn't had a party and wrecked the house while they were away, is to brag to his home game buddies and certain guys at the office of how much he won tonight, with a breakdown of a really big hand or two. He will be less vocal about his failures, as we all are. Next to two big Mitches was a methy Mike, a harrowed man who'd been tested in untold skirmishes, of which the poker table was only one. If methy Mike had been married, the lady had packed her bags long ago, and if they had spawned, their parenting goals probably ended with making sure their kid didn't get a tattoo on her face, and they did not always succeed. Often locals, methy Mikes are on a first-name basis with the bosses and dealers and cocktail waitresses, and you can count on hearing a little catching up. Haven't seen you in a while. I've been, had some stuff come up. So I see. Iggy Pop takes a look at these guys and says, wow, he's really let himself go. They are weathered by the sun, by their lifestyles, which you can only guess at, the underlying narrative of their decay, and resemble unfortunates who've been dragged on chains from the back of a beat-up van and left to desiccate in the desert, like one of the down-and-outers in the treasure of the Sierra Madre. Undone by their hardwired inclinations and undying dream of a new start. Luck. They believe in luck, its patterns, its unknowable rules. They will, seeing Pocket Jacks demolish some weekend punter, tell the table, let me tell you a sad story about a pair of jacks. A sad story for every hand, every one of the 1,326 possible starting combinations. And then there was Robotron, wedged in there, lean and wiry and hunkered down, a young man with sunglasses and earbuds, his hoodie cinched tight around his face like a school shooter or bathroom loiterer. Weaned on internet play, Robotron's only here tonight because the feds shut down all the U.S. online poker sites a month ago. Black Friday, something about money laundering. Here with the humans. Otherwise, the Robotrons would have been back in their childhood rooms, eight pixelated tables open on the screen. He can play eight games at once, zip, zip. It's not so hard once you retrain the pathways in the brain, cramming decades of poker experience into 18 months. Why leave the house at all between the poker sites and the porn sites? What are other people for but for robbing or fucking? The goddamn feds, breeding a new generation of libertarians in the subdivisions. Real people talking, breathing, it must be so weird to them. Their earbuds help keep them out, playing music, self-help manuals. If I'm so wonderful, why am I still single, as read by Edward James Olmos? Or the latest invasion plans transmitted from their home planet.
Thanks. So you went into the den and you met these gamblers and you found that you had some, there was some gambler in you. I mean, you didn't feel entirely uncomfortable there. I wanted to ask you about if you think there's a fundamental difference between people who gamble and people who don't. And before you answer that, I just wanted to read one thing that I, a quote that I love from Jackson Lears, who wrote a book called, I think it was called Something for Nothing. I don't actually have the book here, but it's about gambling. And he, this is what Jackson Lears said about gambling and playing cards. From time to time, novelists, theologians, and psychoanalysts have observed the connection between gambling and ancient rituals, such as the casting of runes or lots, practices meant to divine the will of the deity or the direction of the cosmos. While Freud reduced gambling to substitute gratification, a stand-in for masturbation, his disciple, Theodor Reich, called it a question posed for destiny, the longing to be at one, however fleeting, with the will of the cosmos, links the gambler's faith in luck with the Christian notion of grace as a free gift from God. Grace, from this view, could become a kind of spiritual luck, and attempts to conjure it could be a form of serious play, a means of posing ultimate questions about the universe. So he has these very deep theories about gambling and luck and what they mean about the your relationship to the cosmos. When he was reviewed in the New York Times, he was treated with profound contempt by another writer named Caleb Crane. Just a sentence from Caleb Crane that kind of sums up the other side. He says, he doesn't understand gambling. Why take a risk when it serves no end but the systematic fleecing of the gullible by organized crime and unscrupulous politicians? So there's two ways of looking at if there's anything to be gotten from entering this den of vice. What did you feel about the gamblers that you saw there?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, becoming one with the will of the cosmos, I think that's definitely there when you're playing roulette or playing craps, you know, will this number come up? And definitely when you're praying for the seven of diamonds to fill in your flesh or a straight, talking to whatever sort of gods you have to make the flop give you what you need. So, I think there are people who I sort of met in Atlantic City at the cheapo tables, and then there are the sort of folks who are at the World Series of Poker who are playing at a much higher level and have a much better sense of what's going on. And over the weeks I was hanging out with them, I got over my initial, in some cases, revulsion in terms of Methy Mikes. But it's, being intimidated by these guys who are always, talking at the tables. I knew you had jacks. I knew you had 10, fold here because you can't beat me. I came to just see them as just sort of regular people. I mean, as we sort of washed out at the World Series of Poker, the people who I initially found very intimidating, these... real specialists, these scientists of poker, were just, people with mortgages and, a kid in high school that's not testing well and, worried about what they're going to say to the people back home. They took a week off to come to the World Series of Poker, got a hotel room. And what do you do if you go out the first day or second day? Do you just, sort of hang around and pretend like those businessmen who don't tell their families they got laid off? You're just I'm still playing. So I really came to, respect them in a way that was unexpected to me.
Did you ever feel it was a kind of special club, the way that, actors sometimes seem to civilians, or, that they had, people who understand loving cards? Is there some kind of a bond?
Well, having dinner with, a bunch of players or math players, a sort of, subset of pros I hung out with. And they're replaying hands from 10 years ago, 8 years ago, and with perfect recall. It seems crazy. Yeah. I remember personal slights and grudges, and my part of brain is, pretty much focused on that. And these guys instead, remember getting beat by, Tupelo Slim 8 years ago, and they're replaying the hand. And when they see Tupelo Slim next week, they're gonna, they figure out how to outfox him.
Is that a real name, Tupelo Slim? Are you making that?
Probably, just in terms of probabilities, there probably is a slim guy from Tupelo who plays.
Yeah, there has to be one. Moving on. You write a little bit about how writers, or maybe I'm reading into it, but that writers can be constitutionally suited to card playing. Which I found really interesting. Do you think that that playing cards says something about a writer's need to be engaged with the world, but also to be kind of alone at the same time? That it's the right amount of distance and engagement?
No, I mean, I think definitely, any kind of artist is part of the community, but also on the outside observing. And when I was preparing for the story, I'd be taking notes and trying to play, but also trying to, take notes on the types. And if you're playing at a really high level, you're also in the game, and then also thinking about the persona you've been projecting over years or days or just at this table, and how you're going to switch it up at the right time. A phrase that kept coming up as sort of a cliche in the manuals was, the story you're telling with your hand. And of course, by betting, bluffing, being aggressive, sandbagging, being passive, you're telling a story to the other players, and over a hand and orbit levels. And so there's, you know, there's definitely a storytelling there. I liked it as a shut-in because I could like be elbow to elbow with people and not talk to them. You know, definitely when I was like, losing money, I'd be like, can I get change for like this $1,000 chip or whatever? The dollar amounts had nothing to do with actually how much money I had. But you could just be among people and not have to say anything, which I liked.
Yeah.
And then part of the reason I got into writing was like to sit on my butt all day. And of course, at the poker table, you're sitting on your butt. You're working, supposedly. Like when you're writing, you're working. But you're immobile, which is like a position I like.
Do you find the passage of time when you're playing cards to be very pleasant? I find the time passes just so quickly, and whatever it is I'm anxious about just seems to fade away. I just find it like this kind of magical space. I don't know.
No, I mean, it is very dreamy, and even when you're not playing and waiting for, you know, a good hand or, you know, a place where you can do something, I find that, you know, that it does sort of just pass very quickly. Even when you're just observing and waiting, there's something, I think, very dreamlike about stepping beyond that sort of barrier into the poker room, and then you enter this sort of new, different temporal space.
Yeah, that's nicely put. In one part of the book, you talk about when you've been playing cards since you were a kid. I mean, you were drawn to cards since you were a kid. When you were in a poker game in the 90s, you talked about you would stay in too long, you would chase a, you know, an inside straight. And it was kind of like being interested in girls who weren't attracted to you. And I wondered if you think that card playing matures as you mature. I mean, do you play a more mature game now than you did when you were chasing inside straights?
I know the probabilities of a bit better now. I think in both arenas. I think, yeah. I'll leave it there. Yeah. But I think, you know, when you're hoping for cards, you're hoping for something to complete your hand. You're being a romantic about the world, and you're very hopeful. And so when you're dwindling in a tournament, or you need, again, the seven of diamonds, there is something sort of quaint and naive at thinking that card will show up. Against all odds, suddenly it's going to appear and everything will work out. Yeah. So it is sort of romantic.
It is, yeah. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your relationship to plot, because this is a nonfiction book, but Colson, as you probably know, has written 6 really amazing novels, each one completely different from the other. But there are, of course, similarities, the sensibility, which is also very much in this book, which I'll get to in a minute. But the way he plays with plot, in my words, you may not describe it like this, but I would say that he kind of plays with the reader a little bit. He says, I know what you expect the plot to be, but it's not going to be that. I mean, you're not going to be able to guess where it's going. And this book is a little bit that way, in that he tells you very soon into the book that he does not make the final table of the World Series of Poker like James McManus does in his book. You know, it's not going to end on this triumphant note. And he tells you that very early, so then you're wondering, you know, what it's building to. And it's just a way of playing with your expectations and with conventional ways of dealing with plot. And I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about your relationship to plot.
Sure. I mean, I definitely do a lot of plotting before I start a book. I have to know the beginning and the end. The middle can be fuzzy. And when I start writing, it can change around, but I sort of have to know where I'm going. I guess in my dorky way, I feel that it's hard enough to find the words each day. If I actually know what's going to happen each day, it seems twice as hard. So if I have an outline, I know that I wake up, I'm going to introduce the sheriff or the district attorney. I have a mission each day, and that sort of makes it easier. I just have to concentrate and find the right words. So when I was doing the assignment, I had a sort of beginning, middle, and end because I was training, and it seemed that training part was, I was getting sort of good material and would be a good sort of foundation for the book. I started thinking about ways to organize the nonfiction book. I knew that I wanted it to be very vernacular. You know, I start off my apprenticeship writing at the Village Voice in the early 90s, doing sort of jokey reviews of music, books, and film. And I miss that persona. You know, I can't have that in every book. And so it's been years since I've done it. And I wanted to sort of let it rip with sort of pop culture jokes and my weird, absurd humor. So I knew the voice was going to be that. And also part of a thing I've been doing on Twitter, like social media wouldn't seem to be my sort of thing, but I sort of fell into Twitter just from being home all day and trading weird jokes with people. And at that time, I was doing a voice I called Performative Despair, where I would just say really depressing things that would make me laugh, and then hopefully other people would laugh too. And it seemed that voice sort of fit the desperation I was feeling about being unprepared for going. And then I guess, and that's where the Republic of Anhedonia thing came in. It was the World Series of Poker. What country would I represent? And I'm American, yeah, but also anhedonia from, you know, from a psychology, going back to Freud, the inability to feel pleasure. I always felt a real kinship with that word. And I seen the Republic of Anhedonia was another sort of homeland I belonged to. And if I was playing for me, if I lived there, probably other people live there too, and maybe Methy and Mike or other home game players who would really want to go to the World Series but would never go. So the kind of structural gambits I use in fiction seem to lend themselves really early to organizing the nonfiction thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up the Republic of Anhedonia. I wanted to give people just a little sense of what that, in case you haven't read the book, of what that is like, because it's, I find it so enjoyable, but I'm very perverse myself. But so, for instance, when Coulson describes him, well, at the beginning of the book, he is, he doesn't say this, but he is the author of six novels. He's newly divorced. And he describes himself going on this assignment to the World Series of Poker as a middle-aged man already bowing and half broken under his psychic burdens, decides to take on the stress of being one of the most unqualified players in the history of the big game. So then he says that he is representing the Republic of Anhedonia, which is Woody Allen's original title for Annie Hall, right, Leo? Anhedonia, somebody who can't experience pleasure. Okay, so here, just a couple other just little tidbits from that Republic that I enjoyed. He's talking to one of the math players, that is one of the really smart kids who know all the math involved with the cards. They start talking about TV shows, about watching what Coulson calls hate watching, you know, reality shows. And Terrence asks him, why do you keep watching them if you hate them? And Coulson says to himself, really simple, some days all you have is gazing upon horror and the small comfort of being surprised that it is not yours. Let's see, just a couple more dispatches from Anhedonia. He talks about, describing his country. He says he's temperamentally suited to hold out for good cards, well accustomed to waiting. We Anhedonians have adapted to long periods between good news. Our national animal is the hope camel. We have no national bird. All the birds are dead. And one more. Let's see. D. It's very unorganized. A dinner companion invites him to go to a strip club in Vegas when he's in Vegas, and he says, I demurred, spoiled by the exotic review of anhedonia, the exotic reviews of anhedonia, where the performers remain fully clothed but get emotionally naked, delivering monologues about their top-shelf disappointments and times when they were almost happy. Hard to enjoy American-style strip clubs after that. Once you go bleak, you never go back. So it's really fun. I was going to ask you, I feel like this style comes so naturally to you, but is there ever, you know, when you're writing, like a tension between, you know, not getting too dark and not getting too trivial, you know, with the...
Sure.
You know?
I think in terms of, like, you know, pop culture references and being sort of more hit and run than I usually am in books, you know, I've had books where there's no pop culture, say The Intuitionist takes place in a sort of alternative, you know, noirish type universe where there are no movies, there's no music and no television. And it seemed like that sort of made sense for that book. John Henry Days is very much invested in pop culture and the way we sort of receive music and entertainment. So I think I knew with the I wanted to be sort of fleet and limber with the voice, and that meant referencing Towering Inferno and the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie, you know, in one sentence and not explaining it or giving it context as I usually would, mm-hmm. Sort of wedding those two things in a way that is, you know, I find forbidden sometimes in fiction. But that's sort of what I wanted to do. And then in terms of the bleakness, it seemed to fit. I mean, it fit my mood. And then I would write something horrible, and I would sort of laugh, like, that's really dark. I'll leave it in there, you know? Because ultimately, even though it is, you know, really bleak, it was sort of making me feel better. And I think that was sort of maybe the test for what should go in and go out. Did the initial... does the reference of the Towering Inferno fit perfectly, and it's okay not to explain it for once or give it context, as I do maybe Sag Harbor, where I was explaining like early hip hop and its meaning to the narrator. And then making weird, bleak jokes, which I think if I'm sort of chuckling, I think other people, a certain percentage would probably chuckle too or see themselves in it. One of the weird things that happened with the book was sort of divorced guys sort of relating to like the weird divorce humor, which is sort of dark. Mm-hmm. And when I was writing, I was like, am I going too far or not? But I think it sort of captures a weird moment in my life. And I was sort of, I mean, I don't go on and on about it. You know, no. Who wants to hear about that? But it does sort of pop up here and there. And other people can, you know, I think when you're sort of in between, an in-between stage in your life, I think some of the humor appealed to people mm-hmm. in a weird way. I don't know.
Are you in a better mood now?
Well, it's weird because, like, you know, I'm on the road and people are like, you don't seem to, you know, half dead inside. You smile and stuff. So, you know, things have changed. Like, yeah, I met someone a few months later when we got married and have a kid. And so my life is sort of in a very different place than it was then. But I still am half dead inside, even though I have more going on.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah, thanks.
Let's see. I already asked you that one. I wanted to... You're writing about Vegas and the America that we live in and what Vegas tells us about the America that we live in. I thought it was really great. I wanted to share a little bit of that and ask you about that. Let's get rid of that. Okay, just a couple of passages about being in Vegas. They're all short. I had been here before in American cities of a certain size, a bunch of gnawed wing bones before me, drinking beer alone among flat screens and dead eyes. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, because in the end, whatever goes down, whatever you get up to, your triumphs and transgressions, nobody actually understands what it means except for you. What did it mean to you in your secret heart to win that money or lose that money, to hold that person, to see them walk away? It is unshareable. No one to narc on you to the folks back home. The only narc here is you. I love that passage. And then here's another little thing about Vegas. I pity people who have never been to Vegas, who dismiss the city without setting foot on its carpeted sidewalks. I'll forgive the sanctimony in the question, but what do you do there, the obnoxious self-regard? Sanctimony and self-regarders, American as smallpox blankets and supersized meals. As a foreigner, I make a point never to judge the cultural norms of my adopted country. And then one more thing about Vegas. The mere fact of Vegas, its necessity, was an indictment of our normal lives. If we needed this place to transform into a high roller or a sexy swinger or to be someone else, a winner for once, then certainly the world beyond the desert was a small and mealy place. So I'm seeing very ambivalent feelings toward Vegas. I mean, you are condemning it, and you're also really appreciating it.
Sure, yeah. I mean, when I first went there, 91, after college, on a road trip, I thought I would sort of disdain it. It's campy Vegas, it's kitschy Vegas. Who are these losers who go? And then I put a nickel in a slot machine and won $5 and was immediately converted. I think because I grew up in New York and New York is very dirty and I never had experience with malls. Like, I like really artificial spaces like airports, like really new airports and malls, and the way Vegas has now become as the engineers and architects of the leisure industry have sort of concentrated on it, just become sort of bigger and better and more efficient. And I think one of the first questions was about, is there something different about gamblers? And I think there's something different about people who don't understand Vegas. I mean, like, you don't have to gamble, go to the spa, get some food, just like check out, it's like a nice 48 hours where you can drop out of your normal life. And it doesn't mean like bad behavior. I think it just means like having a, maybe it's like a 22nd century type vacation on a holodeck or something. That's what I sort of feel like Vegas is sometimes. And it is pretty harmless. Like, especially now, you quoted Caleb Crane talking about organized crime trying to, kill people. They want you to come back. They want you to bring their reward card and punch in and get a discount next time and bring the family. And, they're really not out to get you. And any sort of weakness you bring there is your own weakness, I think.
Mm-hmm. And also you write about how Vegas has changed in our lifetime, or maybe more my lifetime. But it's not, because America's changed. You say there is no such thing as a seedy underbelly when everybody's on their back airing out their bits. Years of viral YouTube atrocities, C-listers sex tapes, and a million texted nudie shots have collapsed the time travel to the desert. Like Shecky Green, we are all a bit Vegas now, more comfortable exposing ourselves in all our weaknesses and appetites. And the culture has changed, I think, and embraced our seediness with kind of more cheerfulness than we did when Vegas was created.
Yeah, I mean, I just read this great book, Annihilation by Jeff Vandermeer. It's sort of like this new trilogy just came out. And it's sort of H.P. Lovecraft meets, I keep talking this book up, it's really weird. I'm obsessed with it. H.P. Lovecraft meets Tarkovsky's Stalker, this late 70s science fiction movie about a zone. And basically there's like a weird place in the country that's been colonized by aliens, and it's sort of cordoned off and people go in expeditions. And then the border keeps expanding, and eventually the universe of Area X is sort of taking over the country. And that's sort of like Vegas, I guess. Little pockets of Vegas are infecting us, and we don't have to travel there anymore because it comes to us through our various entertainments, I think, all the time.
It's also a little bit like your novel Zone One, that you what you just described.
Zones, barriers falling, yes. Obsessed, yeah, I guess.
I wanted to return to the Brotherhood of Card Players because you write about it. You write about it really well later in the book, let's just see here. Here it is. It's kind of a really nice. Okay, Just two more short passages from the book. This one is about what happens when you play cards that I find very true for myself. You say, I didn't want to be healed, but there was something in the cards I needed. Memory is the past with volume control. Turn it up, turn it down. Can I make out what I heard in the cards? The martial snap of an expertly shuffled deck, the sleek whisper of laminated paper jetting across the table. Colson played cards since he was a little kid. He played crazy eights and then spit. And then when he went to college, he played hearts. And he says, I'd prowl around the dorm on becalmed afternoons, searching for hearts players like the disheveled emissary of a ramshackle sect. Everyone was busy studying or calling their people back home or whatever, except for me. Cards killed the hours, then bridge, then poker. The games that helped me unscramble the secret message. The next card is the one that will save me. And then finally, one more passage near the end of the book. He wonders what Johnny Moss, who was the first champion at the World Series of Poker, would think if he could see what Vegas is like now. What if he came back and he saw how it had transformed from an intimate competition among buddy rivals into a multi-million-dollar international event bigger than any single individual? If Johnny Moss walked into the pavilion today and saw the thousands of players worrying their stacks, the tables upon tables of hopeful souls, heard the symphony of crickets, I think he'd say, deal me in. It's not mine, but it is cards. And again, that brings me back to this kind of like, there's just a fellowship about playing cards that is so beautiful. And I think that you write about that very well.
No, thanks.
That's not really a question, is it?
No. but, you know, I did feel, you know, I did sort of let down my barriers that the more I played, the more I felt comfortable, you know, with these dudes. And definitely the first day, as I said before, people had taken a week off work and come out. There were 6,800 people playing the World Series in 2011. And the first time I was at, people were playing very tight, very conservatively, because no one wants to come out there and then go out first round, first level, first day. And so there was one sort of, he wasn't really Robotron, he was sort of playing at a higher level, but a young player who was sort of running over everybody and taking all our money while everyone was sort of folding at the slightest hint of aggression. And then I played at a more aggressive table, and it was very harsh, and no one was really sort of joking. And then as the days went by, and I was reporting, I was out, and I was reporting, I would just see people I played with, and it was like, you know, we're just humans again. Like, you know, comparing how the cards are running, the stacks, and, you know, it was just business, nothing personal. And sort of breaking through and then spending, you know, these hours with these dudes, because it is mostly dudes, in the sort of poker theater of aggression. And then just like, I washed out, you washed out, you know, got a cigarette. Like, you know, yeah. it was sort of nice, you know, it was just sort of jarring to go back and forth and then it's sort of normal. Because it's just people who like cards and really wanted to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, I feel like you've gotten so many good reviews in your career that I can ask you about one bad review that you got because I think it's kind of interesting, if that's okay.
Sure, no, I saw my mom last weekend and like, what's up with that dude?
Yeah, I talked to her today. And you know, like a journalist, you know, I saved the harsh question for the end, but as cowardly. But it was very interesting because you wrote a review. It was in 2002. It was a pan, and it was a beautiful pan. It was like, it should be in books of great pans. I mean, I don't know if any of you like reading reviews. There's something just so fantastic about a great pan. I mean, we don't like to admit that, but there's something beautiful about it. So you panned a book of story collection by Richard Ford, and it was just done very artfully and writerly. It was just really fantastic. Richard Ford was not thrilled, apparently. There might have been an incident where he might have spit on you at a party or something. I don't know. But But then you got a not great review in the New York Times for this book by Dwight Gardner, which, by the way, you know, reminded me of Jackson Lear's getting a terrible review in the New York Times for his book. I think they just don't approve of gambling or something. But anyway, and it was interesting to me because, well, this is what Dwight Gardner said. He said, I'd never want to pronounce on another human's depression, but there is something yin-yang about watching a writer being handed a laughably great assignment. Here's $10,000 to try to go to Vegas and win a couple million with it, and then mope in the vaguest of terms about existential despair. I felt that was unfair because you have a worldview, and what are you going to do? Where are you going to put it? But I thought it was interesting because one of the things you accused Richard Ford of was whining. And that's kind of what Dwight Gardner is accusing you of here.
Sure.
And I just thought that was interesting kind of.
Well, the circle is complete. The circle is complete because Dwight Gardner actually assigned me that review and edited it. So. that's the wheel of
karma. That is
karma.
Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, Richard Ford did spit on me. He's sort of like old Southerner.
They're so polite.
Doesn't want to be sass mouthed by the Negroes, kind of guy. I'm not going to spit on Dwight Gardner. You know, he has his own burdens, and it's just a bad review.
Well, everyone gets them. I mean,
sure, yeah. In terms of whining, yes, the urban neurotic whine is a whine. Can you do it in a way that's humorous, in a way that people can relate to? I grew up with cable TV very early, because if we had cable, we sort of have to talk to each other in my household. And so so early exposure to Woody Allen, David Brenner, and then sort of, not really, I wouldn't say they're urban neurotics, but George Carlin and Richard Pryor. People who are talking about their sort of terrible personal stuff and then making it in a way that's accessible. It is so private, like Richard Pryor talking about his childhood in a whorehouse, which is a very, not necessarily a universal experience. But how can he get it across? How can he complain about it and make his sort of complaints into something something artful that people can relate to? So I am a whiner.
Hi.
Can I, and then if that's going to be your sort of domain, can you do it in a way that other people can relate to or find amusing or pitiable, and pitiable in a way that they will keep reading?
Well, I think you achieved it. I think we can open up for questions, if anyone has any, do any poker players or readers of literature have any questions?
Whether or not there's a nod to David Foster Wallace or not, one of his favorite words was, of course, anhedonia as well. And so I was wondering if you could talk about your relationship to him, and just in terms of literary, the literary relationship, whether or not you're making an allusion there or not.
Sure. No, I mean, the word, you know, exists outside of him. He's great. I love Infinite Jest definitely a lot. Working at a newspaper, you know, I didn't want to sort of stretch the truth with the book. I mean, outside the conceit of Republic of Anhedonia, I didn't want to sort of take novelistic liberties with my experience. I think in terms of his nonfiction journalism, like me, very influenced by new journalists from the 70s and 80s. And so people who were taking the devices of fiction and applying them, whether it's in terms of voice or structure, inserting yourself into the story, and using those techniques stereotypically or, you know, whether legitimately or not, assigned to the realm of fiction to nonfiction. So definitely I grew up reading that kind of stuff, and I'm sure he did as well.
I'm curious about your observations. You said most of the people who play at these tournaments are dudes.
Sorry?
You said most of the people who play at these tournaments are dudes.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you observed anything specific, is there, about the women who play? Because I have a friend who's a really, really serious player, and she's frequently the only woman at the table, and it's just so outside of my universe. I wonder how you see it, and what you, is there any sort of central narrative connecting those women?
I'm not sure. I mean, in terms of demeanor, a lot of it seems the female pros are wearing sort of tomboyish Annie Oakley type gear. We didn't talk about her, but once I took the assignment, it seemed I should really take it a little more seriously. I was buying cash money game books as opposed to tournament poker books, and I was buying the wrong books, and I was getting sort of upset as the World Series approach, so I got a poker coach, and my poker coach was a woman named Helen Ellis, who has written a YA novel, another novel, and came from a gambling family, and so she's a bit in the book, and she was actually the person who told me what to read properly, like how to eat, like at a casino, how to play, and she, her sort of persona is Southern housewife. You know, when people are sort of at the table, ask her what she does. She's like, "I'm a housewife." She's Southern, and while they sort of flirt and condescend to her, you know, she takes their money. So that's sort of her shtick. So I mean, I can't talk about how she came to the game. It seemed a lot of people who I talked to had fathers who were big gamblers, and Helen talked about on her 21st birthday. Her dad met her in front of Caesars in Las Vegas. She came from New York, and said, "You know, this is the center of the universe, and now you're 21. We can gamble together." So is that bad? You know, he loves cards. She loves cards, and sort of brings them together. I certainly don't think so. There's a woman, Vanessa Selbst, who's like sort of a huge pro now, who's had a great couple of years. There's been sort of a dry spell in terms of really sort of top female players who are making it to the getting bracelets at the World Series. So I can't sort of say what makes the female player versus a male player. It's a white male dominated game. You know, you grow up with the games that you are introduced to as a kid. Helen, like a lot of people, the pros I met were introduced to gambling at a very sort of early age and loved it. And part of it was bonding with their families.
She didn't ask me, but I just want to say one thing to you. Because I play poker a lot in casinos, and I find, and I'm frequently the only woman at the table, and I love it because it feels so transgressive, and yet it's also very safe. I mean, as long as you play carefully and, you know, you have limits. But I mean, it's for me, it's a very, I feel very transgressive doing it, and it feels really good. So.
Next question, right over here.
When you were talking about bleakness earlier, and you were saying that you would think of something really messed up in your head and then laugh to yourself. When you have those thoughts, do you try and keep them closer to your chest before you share them with others? Because I find that sometimes when you do those things and you share them with other people, they'll have a real reaction like, "Oh my God, are you okay?" And then you're like, "Oh, you just fucked up the joke. Like, why are you doing that?" And then do you try and keep it sort of like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, going back to social media, like I'm not on Facebook, but it seemed like Twitter was a good sort of venue for me. Yeah, as I say in the book, like, you know, I'm home all day, and like I used to talk to my cat, and my cat died, and the stuff I would say to my cat, I just started doing on Twitter instead, and it seemed to work out. And then if I had some kind of weird thought about anhedonia or despair, I would just sort of tweet it, and then people would laugh, and it seemed. It was okay. So I think that sort of broke down my barriers in terms of having more of a filter between me and you know, weird, absurdist humor.
Do you have any interest in exploring the biology or the genetics of gambling? And are you in any way a believer in the so-called risk gene or risk-aversive gene?
I don't know much about it, but I know that, you know, there are people who just have no interest in gambling. And I think I'm pretty risk-averse. I mean, I love cards. I love playing poker for small stakes, but I'm really cheap. And if I lose like $200, you know, I don't want to play for a while. So I can never become a pro. So I like risk on a small level. Maybe that means I only have a bit of that gene or whatever, you know. You know, when I'm done with the book, I'm really done with the subject. I haven't played poker as much as I used to, you know, before I did the book. Definitely, I wrote a book about elevators. I have to go in elevators, but I don't come up with weird Baroque theories about elevators as the way I did before. Nor do I want any John Henry paraphernalia, as I sometimes get from people who are very well-meaning. But the last thing I want to do is get some John Henry shit in the mail. I'm probably not going to continue my investigations into gambling right now.
Hi. I'm actually one of these people that has no interest in gambling. And I'm also a fairly optimistic person who doesn't really relate to the humor of bleakness and things like that. So I'm sitting here, and I'm thinking about what brought me here, and I thought the title, The Noble Hustle, reminded me of The Noble Lie. And I guess the thing that I'm wondering about is what is endearing me to you, despite the difference of opinion I have about so many things, is that there's an observer above or beyond your observer. So you're observing from a cynical, urban, whiny perspective, but yet beyond that, there's another observer, and I was wondering if you can comment on who that observer really is as you're writing.
He's a very scared little boy who I don't let out very much. Crafting a voice for a book, whether it's The Intuitionist or Sag Harbor, you know, some of my novels, or in this. You know, it's a constructed thing. I talked about to the person over there about maybe social media breaking down some of my barriers. But I'm not just like spilling my guts onto the page. I am choosing what I want to say and disclose, and then hopefully the disclosures are phrased in a way that serves the book and are entertaining to the reader. I'm observing, and then there's the process of taking all these thoughts and communicating them to other people, which is, you know, sort of writing and art. And so the person in the book is not me unfiltered. It's a sort of constructed person out of things that I did and thought while I was going to World Series.
Thank you for this talk. It's very, I'm enjoying it. And I'm curious, have you had any encounters with anybody who's actually been diagnosed as anhedonic? And if so, like, I'd be interested to know. Like, I mean, because I don't think you really are anhedonic. I think you're doing that ironically, right? So I can relate to being ironically anhedonic, but I'm curious if you've ever met anyone who's actually been diagnosed as such.
Sure. They probably don't get out much, and then neither do I. So it cuts down on the probability of meeting them. My ironic anhedonia, which keeps me as a shut-in, and their actual anhedonia, which keeps them as, you know, even more bona fide shut-ins, probably cuts down on you know, the Venn diagram of anhedonians, so.
Hi. I had another question, but you touched on the Facebook thing and you mentioned that you weren't on there. So first I'd like to applaud you, especially as like a public figure who has to market yourself. You don't see too much of that anymore. I'm also not on Facebook and I've never been on a social network. But what I'd like to ask is, in terms of, like, you seem to have a skill, like your craft is something of social observation and human interaction. And I think that as a writer myself, I think that Facebook is kind of the antithesis of that, and it kind of kills it. So if you wanted to comment on that, is that your reason for staying off, or not to be stalked, or just what do you think as far as human interaction, how Facebook is affecting that, and will it kind of take away the material that you have to work with as everybody kind of puts more energy into that virtual world as opposed to the actual world?
Yeah, I mean, I have nothing against Facebook. It just never seemed to be something I want to do. And but that's how you want to spend your time. Some people are on Facebook. Other people are hand gliding. Some people are playing cards. So whatever takes away. I was going to do some ironic anhedonia statement about whatever kills the pain, but whatever gets you through, you know, through your existence is fine. So I don't think of how Facebook affects my craft or stuff like that. I know people are like, oh, I don't want to be on Twitter, and I definitely am. You know, I like Twitter. I'm sick of Twitter. You know, at both things at once. But people say, oh, doesn't it take away from your writing? And it's like, no, actually, you know, the fart joke was not going to go in the book about slaves. You know, my work is one thing, and then sort of making weird jokes on Twitter is something different. You know, if I had an office job, I would probably be shunned by some of the things I say. But I would be catching up with people about news and pop culture in a way that I do on Twitter. So as someone who works at home, it's just a sort of way of having a community.
You started this evening reading the opening of the book, and you characterized some of the players that you met at the low stakes table. And I would think one of the things that writers and poker players share, good ones, is the ability to read and characterize people. So if you were sitting across from yourself at the table, how would you characterize yourself both as a person and as a card player?
Sure. as a card player, I'll just go from what other people have told me, that I often have an expressionless mask on my face. Because I'm a soulless monster who can't actually feel real human emotions. And while that doesn't really help in relationships, it does actually help at the poker table. People project things onto you. You know, I'm just thinking about my mortgage and a bad thing I'm brooding over that happened to me when I was six. And people think, like, oh, he has a great hand. He's going to destroy me. So what people told me, that serves poker. As a person, I don't know, likes long walks on the beach, nice romantic dinners. I'm hoping I'm giving that off, you know, tonight, I guess.
Oh, well, that was really fun.
It was very fun. Thank you all for coming. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.